Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. Jose Diaz had no aspiration to be an agent of societal change. He was just a 22-year-old trying to live his life. That meant his goals were much more grounded in the now. The son of Mexican refugees, he grew up among the working poor in Los Angeles, struggling through the Depression like everyone else did, constrained by the kind of racial segregation that existed in the South. But he didn't live in the South. He lived in California. And Los Angeles was very clear about where his kind had to live and where they could work. But that life was still better than the one the Diaz family had endured in earlier years in the state of Durango, where there was little to eat and a lot to be afraid of. At least here, there was food. Jose's family had left Mexico in the 1920s amid violent political unrest. They found life across the border safer. Here, they became itinerant farm workers, moving seasonally through California to where the work was, harvesting vegetables in the Central Valley and picking oranges and strawberries around LA, all to feed the rest of the nation that lay to the east. But a decade later, times were hard everywhere. Jose lived with his family in southeast Los Angeles County in a working-class Mexican-American neighborhood tied to the 38th Street area, miles from downtown and a world away from the power structures that would soon decide his fate. Jose had left after eighth grade to work, turning over his earnings to his parents to help support the family. His siblings would later describe him as quiet, reserved, conservative for his age. He favored a specific style of suit. He and his family lived in one of the rough-built homes that had originally been ranch bunkhouses when L.A. was cattle country. A little more than a mile and a half from there was a scrubby reservoir which someone had dreamily called Sleepy Lagoon. It's where, on August 2, 1942, Jose would be found gravely injured after a late-night fight. Exactly what caused his death was disputed from the start, but police quickly labeled it murder. He was bleeding from the mouth and stomach when he was found clinging to life, only to be rushed to a hospital too late to save him. He had just been to a birthday party for Eleanor Delgadillo Coronado, a young woman whom Jose had grown up with in the bunkhouse community. It was to be a friends and family celebration. As was all too common in those days, earlier that night, down at the lagoon, there had been a violent confrontation between the various young people who lived on the city's east side. Jose didn't seem to have been part of that earlier fracas, but he would be the lone casualty that day of the bad blood that ran between Mexican-American youth factions over, among other things, territory, identity, and cultural pride. His death and the convictions of his suspected killers would act as a prelude to riots that rocked Los Angeles the following summer. Both would force Los Angeles and the country to look at the fundamental inequality within the American justice system and foster a renewed awareness that the enemy within is as insidious and harmful as the one we faced beyond our borders. This episode is going to introduce you to a word I wasn't familiar with. Some of you, of course, will already know it. Please excuse my ignorance. The word is pachuco. It likely was coined in the border cities of Texas and traveled linguistically south and west along the border. It's a word that defines a particular Mexican-American subculture, circa the middle years of the 20th century. James Diego Vigil, a University of California Irvine anthropologist and the author of Understanding Street Gangs Through Urban Anthropology, explained the term in the Daily Chelas episode on Chicanos and the Zoot Suit.
El Paso is where it was formulated into an example of a label for Mexicans who dressed differently, who spoke differently, who were Americans, but not really. And the Pachuco is the label they use, even though the suits they wore were Zoot Suits, something developed by blacks in the 1930s. But they had their own style, and it moved to other places of the Southwest, especially Los Angeles.
Ah, the Zoot Suit. This might be my first ever foray in this podcast into fashion, so stay with me. As Dr. Vigil said, the style took shape in black jazz culture, rooted in the Harlem ballrooms and dance floors of the Roaring Twenties, and fully formed by the 1930s when urban trendsetters embraced clothing that moved with the music. And plus, they just look good. The Zoot Suit's large coat had especially wide and padded shoulders and an especially long length that drifted to mid-thigh. Its pants were high-waisted and ballooned wide through the hip, then tapered tightly at the ankle. Bandleader Cab Calloway called the attire totally and truly American. The style drifted west and into working-class Mexican-American culture in the 40s and became a symbol of the Pachuco culture. It was not the last time that music, read that rock or punk or hip-hop, would influence fashion. But now that we're dressed, let's get back to Los Angeles circa 1942. America was born of diversity, of course, what with the wide range of immigrants that landed on its shores from the 1800s on. Los Angeles was no different. Even today, you can travel around the city and find explicitly named locales such as Koreatown, Little Tokyo, Chinatown, Little Ethiopia, Little Bangladesh, Filipino Town, Thai Town, and Little Armenia. Boyle Heights is known to be a Latino enclave. Tarangeles, a Persian one. So yeah, the city has impressive ethnic range. The blending has not always been smooth, but it has generally worked for the city of now almost 4 million. Its surrounding metropolitan area, which is as diverse, numbers around 18.5 million. But on this August night in 1942, the grappling was a kind of inner squad scrum, with one group of young Mexican-Americans facing off against another, a continuation of ongoing brushes. Now, you probably think I'm hedging on calling them gangs. I guess I am, because that evokes something specific to us in this day and age, and it doesn't quite match with what was happening back then. But that is the language the LAPD used then. The department identified 50 gangs of quote-unquote Pachuco delinquents roaming the town during that decade. I'm going to have Alice McGrath-Greenfield, a mid-century labor activist, explain my persistence.
The gangs of 1942, 1941, all through the early 40s, were totally different from the gangs as we know them today and the violence as we know it today. They didn't have guns, mostly they didn't have cars, and it was extremely rare for there to be a fatality if they got into a rumble.
And unlike gangs as we know them, they had no hierarchy, no leader. They had no organization to speak of. They had no gang signs, no pledge to the death. Now, I'm not going to say these kids were choir boys. Far from it. Almost all had police records. Most included minor offenses, such as petty theft and joyriding, while something like a quarter had been convicted of more serious crimes. We're talking robbery, assault, auto theft. But, as later investigations would show, most of their records were for suspected criminal activity. That is, they appeared on police rolls as having been suspected of, say, stealing cars, for which they were held in jail for days before being cleared and released, and for other random crimes in which the suspect was identified simply as a young Mexican male. In a lot of these cases, the young men later reported that they had been pistol-whipped and beaten while being interrogated by the LAPD. Not so shocking, I know, but it's pertinent to how the Sleepy Lagoon murder and all that followed unfolded. Now, I've been mentioning males more than females, and there's a reason. The majority of the trouble was the boys' doing. But make no mistake, women who lived in the area were players as well. You'll hear more about that later. Anyway, that summer, the bunch referred to as the 38th Street Gang gathered at the Sleepy Lagoon to swim and carry on in their cars. The little watering hole had just gotten its name from a song that had been popular earlier in the year. Among them was 19-year-old Arizona-born Hank Lavis, who had just enlisted in the Merchant Marine, a tough guy who was known as someone who didn't back down. A car full of drunk Mexican-American kids, the 38 Streeters weren't affiliated with, came by the area shouting challenges and slurs at them in both Spanish and English, and then they drove on. Though the intrusion angered them, the 38th Street bunch continued to enjoy their time at the lagoon that night. Now out of their cars and into the water, a few began to couple up and slide out into the dark. A half hour later, though, one of them yelled. Hank Lavis and his girl Dora were being beaten up in their cars by more than a dozen guys. By the way, Dora's last name is either Baca or Barrios, depending on which source you trust. For simplicity's sake, I'll go with Barrios. Lavis' friends came running to try to stop the thrashing. It was a bit of a free-for-all. After roughly half an hour, the coast finally cleared. The intruders had been young men associated with the Downey Gang. Retribution was in order. News traveled fast. It got to 38th Street and to the crowds and clubs around there. Remember, it was a warm summer Saturday night in Los Angeles in 1942. Everybody was outside. When a bloodied Hank and a weeping Dora showed up, the crowd quickly began trying to figure out where the Downey crew might be. The likeliest place was a birthday party at the bunkhouse community at Williams Ranch. It wasn't far. 22 males and 13 females piled into a few cars. It was about 12:30 a.m. on August 2nd. According to later trial testimony, when the 38th Street bunch were nearing the compound, Benny Alvarez's car got stuck in a ditch. He exited the vehicle to give it a shove out of the crevice it had landed in, but Betty Zeiss and Dora Barrios weren't wanting to wait. They started walking toward the party noise. They were the first to find Jose Diaz crumpled at a back gate. His bloodied face was in the dirt and he could barely speak. Zeiss began to render aid to Diaz, who was already bruised and bleeding profusely from his mouth and gut. A few of the 38th Street boys had gone around the women and entered the Delgadillo party to knock some heads together. Jose Chepe Ruiz and Gus Zamora had clubs and were attacking some other guy who was already beaten and lying on the ground. Zeiss was pulled away from Jose only so Ruiz could now start clubbing the already broken man. One of his own bunch stopped him after a few blows. But there was still a lot of indiscriminate anger roiling the 38th Street gang members. One hit the birthday girl, and someone else punched her father, who had come to his daughter's defense. Soon, though, someone yelled for the 38th Streeters to run, and they all hightailed it back to their cars. Most of them would later testify that they had stayed no more than 10 minutes at the compound. After they left, Diaz was found by the Delgadillos and taken to Los Angeles General Hospital. He was able to answer only a few questions before he slipped into unconsciousness. He died soon after. The death of one Mexican-American gang member by another suspected Mexican-American gang would not seem to be much of a concern to the LAPD in 1942. And in truth, most couldn't have cared less about Jose Diaz, a young man who loved jazz and had died the day before he was set to report to the U.S. Army. He had had his portrait taken just 1 week earlier at his anxious mother's insistence. In it, he's dressed neatly, hair nicely combed. He looks young and ambitious. It's reportedly the only photo ever taken of him. The LAPD saw none of that, but what they did see in the death of Jose Diaz was an opportunity they couldn't pass up. the perceived Mexican-American youth gang problem was about to feel the full force of law enforcement. They figured they would have the support of white suburbanites who didn't much care for the supposed overtaking of their city by these so-called thugs. Wasting no time, LAPD and the LA County Sheriff's Department rounded up 600 Mexican-American youth to question and harass. Some sources indicate that the police were directed to ignore neighborhood affiliation and bring in anyone wearing a zoot suit. But in practice, the dragnet was hardly random. The police knew which neighborhoods they wanted to target. And in some cases, they knew which people. Hank Lavis was top of the list. He had been born in Tucson in 1923, the third of 10 children. His family settled in the 38th Street neighborhood. He had a temper, a lead foot, and what the LAPD would call a chip on his shoulder. But his sister Lupe remembered him as kind-hearted and loyal. He worked as a mechanic, fixing cars for the neighborhood kids who looked up to him. And he saved money from every paycheck to buy his mother silk stockings and beauty creams. Now, Hank Lavis had a record, not because he was a hardened criminal, but because he kept getting arrested. Once, he and his brother were pulled over in their father's car and held for 3 days on suspicion of car theft until their father could prove the car was his. Another time, police arrested him for assault, held him for 3 months, then cleared him of all charges. The LAPD labeled him a delinquent simply because he stood up for his rights. To them, he was a rabble-rouser. By the way, this was a guy who had tried to enlist in the Navy once, but he was refused because of his record, which at that point consisted of only one actual conviction. He had pleaded guilty once to simple assault and was sentenced to 3 months in jail. Hank was among the first rounded up in Jose's death. When his sister Lupe went with their father to the Firestone substation to find him, the officer in charge looked at her and said, "Oh, another Lavis." They locked Lupe in a room with the other arrested girls. An investigator threatened to slap her if she didn't admit to being in the fight. Hank's father finally found his son in the interrogation room. He was unconscious, slumped over in his chair, blood and saliva covering his shirt and mouth. He had been beaten for a confession. But the roundup by no means ended with Hank's arrest. While being questioned, many of the suspected 600 were, per repeated and consistent evidence and testimony, slapped, punched, kicked, and beaten until barely conscious. They were jailed without cause and denied representation. Eduardo Obregón Pagón, an endowed professor at the Arizona State University and the author of Murder at the Sleepy Lagoon, quoted Lieutenant Edward Duran Ayres of the L.A. County Sheriff's Department, who testified before the 1942 Los Angeles County Grand Jury, on his feelings about how such delinquents should be treated and why. Quote, "One cannot change the spots of a leopard. These youths have a total disregard for human life. All he knows and feels is a desire to kill, or at least to let blood. Whenever the Mexican element receives swift and sure punishment, he then, and only then, respects authority." End quote. A formal indictment was handed down on 24 men who had some affiliation with the 38th Street Gang. No women were included in the indictments that alleged a conspiracy to kill Jose Diaz. The women would be dealt with separately. The families of the 24 men charged in Jose Diaz's death did what they could to find representation. Eventually, 7 lawyers were engaged to defend the 24 who were to be tried together. One, a lawyer named Harry Hunt, no known relation, appealed to have his clients, Jose Herrera and Lupe Orozco, tried separately. His motion was granted. They would never be tried. The remaining 22 would be. The prosecutors would be aided in that effort by the Los Angeles Examiner and the Los Angeles Evening Herald and Express, papers owned by William Randolph Hearst. Those papers added fuel to the fire by labeling the defendants, as well as all Mexican-American youth, as criminals, baby gangsters, and, quote, the goons of Sleepy Lagoon, end quote. All before the trial even began. Day after day, the papers reported the need to get rid of the Pachucos and to clean up the city to make it safe for the Anglo community. Later, social critics and progressive activists would argue that Hearst was eager to sow anti-Mexican sentiment and promote the kind of discord that might lead to a purging of the L.A. Basin of the foreign-born, hence upping the value of his Southern California real estate. The Hearst Press, and later others, such as the Los Angeles Times, would begin to shorthand the problem of Mexican-American youth gang violence as that of the Zoot Suiters. It made for snappy headlines and plentiful readership. As did a piece in Sensation, a pulp magazine that was titled Smashing California's Baby Gangsters. The story detailed the activities of the Pachuco gangs and the immorality of their very existence. It referred to them as reckless, mad-brained young wolves who had to be stopped before they committed further murders. The author of that piece was Clem Peoples, the chief of the criminal division of the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Guy Andor's 1944 book, The Sleepy Lagoon Mystery, would suggest that such yellow journalism did much to foment and further racial tensions, upping the chance for an eventual riot. Now, the wheels of the judicial system rolled faster back then. Just 3 months after the killing of Jose Diaz in October 1942, Judge Charles W. Fricke, a.k.a. San Quentin Fricke, called the trial of the 22 to order. Thus began People versus Zamora et al. It should be noted they misspelled the named defendant, Gus Zamora, giving it two M's in the official record. His surname only contained one. Fricke made some interesting judicial choices, the first of which was to remove all the defendants from direct access to their lawyers and place them in the galley. He further did not allow them to bathe, cut their hair, or change their clothes, so they wore the very clothes they'd been originally wearing when picked up for questioning 3 months earlier. Defense attorneys quickly filed a motion to allow their defendants to clean up and dress appropriately for court. That motion was denied. The judge said their appearance was irrelevant. Hardly anyone argued with Fricke. In 1925, he had written the California's Manual of Criminal Law and Procedure for Police Officers. The following year, he had written Outlines of California Criminal Procedure and, the year after that, penned California Criminal Procedure. Fricke had been a prosecutor in the L.A. County District Attorney's Office for 25 years before being elevated to judge. He tended to like prosecutors. Here's William Shibley, the son of George Shibley, a lawyer who was brought in by the efforts of labor organizers after they'd become convinced that the defense was lacking firepower.
Judge Fricke, according to my father, would take his prosecutors aside over lunch hours and educate them on how to introduce evidence. He prided himself in knowing criminal law better than anybody. I think my father felt that he thought of himself as infallible and tended to look down at counsel and look down at people that he didn't agree with.
It did not go well for the defense, despite a constant effort by Shibley to challenge the legality of the prosecution's questioning. Fricke rarely sustained his objections and often belittled Shibley in front of the jury. Yet no one could say that the case had not been given a thorough going through. Alice McGrath explaining what occurred in a nutshell.
In 3 months and 6,000 pages of testimony, not one single witness put any of the defendants on trial near Jose Diaz. It was never proven the cause of death.
It was clear Diaz had been beaten and stabbed, sure, but no one had pinned down precisely what killed him. And furthermore, no murder weapon was ever produced by the prosecution. Others would go so far as to explain that the prosecution had not even proven that there had been a murder. They would argue that his fatal head wounds could have been caused by some kind of collision with a car. I'm not quite sure how a car could have stabbed him, but you get the point. All of it was to no avail. It took the jury very little time to return their mixed verdicts. They found 5 of the accused not guilty. 3, including Hank Lavis, were found guilty of murder in the first degree, as well as guilty of 2 counts of assault with the intent to murder. 9 of the 22, including Gus Zamora, were convicted of murder in the second degree and 2 counts of assault with intent to commit murder. The remaining 5 were found guilty of assault. 3 of the men were given life sentences and 9 were given 5 years to life, all to be served at San Quentin. The rest were given a year to be served at a county jail or road camp. The environment at San Quentin was, as expected, punitive. It was also brutal, with daily incidents of racially motivated inmate-on-inmate violence, poor food, and guard abuse. But that was only half of what the state decided to mete out. The state social service agencies had also detained 8 young women who had been present that fateful night of August 1st with the 38th Streeters. The agencies eventually made them wards of the state and confined them to the Ventura School for Girls. This was something that some of the parents agreed to, apparently, in hopes of getting their daughters away from gang life. But it was mighty harsh punishment for those who were not charged with or convicted of any crime. Here's Elizabeth Escobedo, Associate Professor of Latino History at the University of Denver.
The Ventura School for Girls at this time is really a very repressive institution. One that's custodial and disciplinary procedures completely rival the state prisons of the time. Young women would go to very drastic measures in order to escape going to the Ventura School for Girls because of its bad reputation.
The detained women were called as witnesses in the men's trial. Each refused to give any information that might harm the defense. One, a woman named Lorena Encinas, would much later let it be known that she knew exactly who had killed Jose Diaz. And it was none of the men standing trial. But she refused to say anything on the stand. For now, the response to the verdicts and sentencing, as well as to the slanted way in which the trial had been covered, seemed to awaken the sensibilities of a few Angelenos who thought the 22 Zoot Suiters had not been given a fair trial. And so, the Sleepy Lagoon Defense Committee was formed. They looked to George Shibley to immediately appeal to the state's Second District Court for relief. And experienced activists like Alice McGrath got involved. So did Hollywood luminaries like Orson Welles, Rita Hayworth, Anthony Quinn, Humphrey Bogart, and Lauren Bacall, who funded the effort. So too labor unions like the Longshoremen. In Pagan's book about the case and trial, he wrote, quote, "In the months that followed, Californians would again revive the discourse on the Mexican problem and debate whether Mexican citizens and their American-born children were culturally, politically, intellectually, and biologically capable of living within a white, civilized, democratic society." End quote. In November of 1943, defense attorney George Shibley filed his appeal. It would be almost a year before the courts would rule, but Los Angeles wouldn't wait that long. We are, strangely, back to the matter of Zoot Suits. Through headlines and common parlance, the flashy attire had become a symbol of the pachucos and the culture they emulated. The high-profile Sleepy Lagoon case had raised the level of racial tension and forced the barely concealed vitriol toward that community into plain sight. The actions of the 38th Street Gang were, by extension, viewed as representative of every Mexican-American in the city. No one was blameless. The police had not looked too hard for the real killer of Jose Diaz. The press had pounded the youth gangs as dangerous to the white community. The courts had allowed the prosecution of them when the evidence had not supported conviction. And the Zoot Suits themselves became a flashpoint. It didn't matter that many young men had cobbled theirs together from hand-me-downs because they couldn't afford the real thing. Brawls often started to break out between those wearing the zoot suits and those in military uniforms, as the latter assumed the former were anti-American draft dodgers. According to Dr. Stephanie Hinerschitz, writing for the National World War II Museum, the ridiculousness of that was striking, as some of the suit wearers targeted were as young as 12 years old. And you have to remember that this was a time of peak anxiety during the war, and taken far enough, the zoot suits were seen as a waste of fabric in a time of rationing. The guys wearing them weren't doing their part. The nation had already shown its deep concern about the loyalty of foreigners, especially of the Japanese. By 1943, the U.S. had already placed 120,000 people of Japanese descent into internment camps. Two-thirds of those were American citizens, and yet were taken from their homes and guarded behind barbed wire for the duration of the war. In fact, the Manzanar Free Press, a newspaper written and distributed within the Manzanar War Relocation Center, located in California's Owens Valley, published an editorial about the Sleepy Lagoon case. The writer had called it just another example of the institutional racism that existed in the city. The war was complicating things all around. The U.S. Naval and Marine Corps Reserve Training Center had been built just before the war started in the midst of the Mexican-American community in an area known as the Chavez Ravine. You may know the Chavez Ravine as the location of Dodger Stadium. In a time before freeways, the sailors stationed at the armory, who were all white, had to walk through the working-class ethnic neighborhood adjacent to it in order to get to city buses to get into downtown when given nightly leave. The juxtaposition wasn't friendly. The sailors complained of regular harassment from the locals, and the locals complained that the sailors were overly zealous in their treatment of the young women there. Epithets were slung in both directions. 7 months after the 38th Streeters had been relocated to San Quentin, about a dozen sailors and a group of Mexican-American teenagers wearing zoot suits got into a tussle in Chinatown. It was May 31st, 1943. Here's Dr. Pagan explaining what happened.
As a group of service personnel were passing a group of civilian youth, one young man raised his hand in a manner that one of the sailors thought was threatening. One of the sailors turned around and grabbed the arm of the young civilian, and from that point, the fight broke out. It seemed that both sides were primed for confrontation, and the street seemed to explode in a fight. In the process, the sailor had his jaw broken, he was knocked unconscious, and his buddies had to drag him back to the armory.
This did not land well at the armory. So, a few days later, on June 3rd, 1943, 50 or so sailors went downtown in search of young men in zoot suits. They were armed with gun belts and clubs. Writer Selden Cowles Menifee, author of Assignment USA, reported that, quote, searching parties of soldiers, sailors, and Marines hunted them out and drove them into the open like bird dogs flushing quail. Zoot suits smoldered in the ashes of street bonfires where they had been tossed by grimly methodical tank forces of servicemen, end quote. The kids went home. There was no one to complain to but each other. And who could they report this to? The servicemen reloaded. The next night, they got more organized. Having learned that more Mexican-American communities existed in East L.A. and Boyle Heights, they headed there, ready for war. Taxi drivers reportedly happily drove them around at no charge. When the police department chose to weigh in, it stood by without intervening. When it was forced to do so, it arrested the victims for disorderly conduct or assault. On June 4th, the Oakland Tribune, a Northern California newspaper that would later become notable as one of the few black-owned daily newspapers in the country, called the servicemen a quote-unquote vengeance squad. One young Navy officer told the paper, quote, we are out to do what the police have failed to do. We're going to clean up, end quote. On June 6th, the vigilantes moved their campaign into South Central. Here, they met some resistance from the black neighborhood and discovered that the young people they were trying to scare were getting organized as well. On the fifth day of the rioting, give or take, it's estimated that more than 5,000 civilians showed up to help the sailors. Marietta Lee, a white Angeleno who was a teenager at the time, told PBS's American Experience that she had an idea where she could find reinforcements. There was a Marine Corps air station located in El Toro, just south of Orange County.
My brother was only 14 years old. I was 16 at the time, but I did drive. And we got my mother's car, and we went to El Toro and picked up Marines. Los Angeles was like a war zone, and we had to do something about it. The Pachucos had just taken over. I felt that I was doing my share for the war effort.
Soldiers based in Las Vegas also made their way to L.A. to help out. On June 8th, military higher-ups called a halt to the nonsense by canceling all leave. The city was effectively off-limits to all area service personnel. They even told the military police to do their jobs and arrest those who disobeyed the order. On June 9th, the Los Angeles City Council moved to outlaw zoot suits, passing a resolution aimed at stopping their sale and public display. The events of those days, June 3rd through the 8th by most accounts, though some witnesses described unrest stretching days beyond that, had been dubbed the Zoot Suit Riots by the press. While it should be noted that many were bruised, battered, and suffered broken bones, no one had been killed and no sexual assaults documented. Property was damaged, of course, but it had been a riot of intimidation, not extermination. A reasonable person might ask why the Zoot Suit provoked such anger and why it had to be vanquished until the end of the war. There are a lot of theories on that. Some hold that at the time of the riots, things had not been going the way of the Allies and fear had to leach out somewhere. Minorities are often a target in such situations, and the Zoot Suit was an easy way to spot the group targeted this time. Others posit that the Zoot Suit was seen as a defiant show of lack of interest in the current struggle. It suggested a lackadaisical attitude, an I don't care pose by Mexican-American youth. Historian Pagan agrees the fashion expressed an attitude, but he feels it was one of self-respect. Here he is talking to WW2 TV host Paul Woodage and referencing a photograph taken during that time period.
It's often a way of kind of calling notice to yourself. The other thing I want to point out is if you notice the ratio of the shoulders to the hips to the stride, and what we're seeing here with this photograph is a strut. Their shoulders are thrown back, heads held high, and they're strutting. Why are they strutting? Because they feel empowered by the fashion. And in a period of segregation, when the norm of segregation was that you're supposed to defer to whiteness, you're not supposed to call attention to yourself, because if you do, there are consequences. For young people to put on this fashion and stand up straight and strut down the road, you are now challenging the norms of society, the unwritten norms of society.
And there, perhaps, was the real crime. Not what the young men in zoot suits had done, but what they had dared to be. Visible, proud, and undefeated. In wartime Los Angeles, that was threat enough. When violence like the Zoot Suit riots erupt, people want something to blame and something to fix. This little interval of immigrant hunting had its share of both. Los Angeles Mayor Fletcher Bowron blamed the lawlessness on juvenile delinquency in the Mexican-American community. Quick aside, Bowron had been a key proponent of Japanese internment and a leading voice of anti-Japanese prejudice during World War II. Seems like it was his knee-jerk to blame brown people. The Mexican embassy demanded an explanation, even while that nation was conflicted about the Pachucos, who weren't, per one Mexico City newspaper, truly Mexicans and an affront to the public. On June 16th, First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt decried the violence and explicitly labeled it racist. The men convicted in connection with killing Jose Diaz were among those most surprised by the riots. One of those men, Manny Reyes, informed Alice McGrath in a letter that he recognized two of his friends' battered faces on the front pages of a newspaper reporting on the fighting. He wrote, quote, "I never dreamed that things like this would happen in the USA, a land of freedom," end quote. Governor Colbert Olson had, earlier in 1942, ordered a crackdown on the city's juvenile gangs and told them explicitly to, quote, "take such steps as will bring about their termination," end quote. In 1943, future Supreme Court Chief Justice Earl Warren, elected governor in 1942 and inaugurated that January, set up a commission to investigate what that termination order had wrought. It would conclude that, quote, "the existence of racial prejudice cannot be ignored," end quote. Senator Jack Tenney of the California Senate Fact-Finding Subcommittee on Un-American Activities offered up outside agitators, claiming it was all the work of communist agents and Axis spies stirring up racial trouble for their own ends. The nation stewed. Meanwhile, the Sleepy Lagoon Defense Committee had been busy. They had launched a major publicity campaign that raised money to pay for the appeal. The convicted men would say later that the support they received gave them a measure of hope they previously had had no reason to expect. Back in the courts, the three judges on the California Second District Court of Appeal pondered what to do as they reviewed the trial transcripts of the murder of Jose Diaz. It took a year before the court issued its ruling. In October 1944, it unanimously reversed the convictions of the 17 who had been put in state prison. Their stated reasons? Judge Charles Fricke had been overtly and obviously biased, which resulted in an abundance of legal error. He had denied the defendants access to counsel. He hadn't allowed them to wear clean clothes. Further, they concluded that the evidence presented in that three-month-long case did not support a guilty verdict. Hank Leavis and his friends had served 2 years in prison. Upon leaving, a prison guard was heard to say, "They'll be back." They were all released, and the records in the case cleared. The prosecution could have retried them. They chose not to. The guard wasn't entirely wrong about some of them coming back. Hank Leavis was one. Not long after his release, embittered and struggling to find his place, he was arrested for selling drugs and sentenced to 10 to 12 years. Who knows if he would have gone down that path if he hadn't been wrongly imprisoned first. And what of the mystery of who killed Jose Diaz and why? You may notice that I referenced the PBS American Experience episode on the Zoot Suit riots a few times. It was terrifically helpful and contained a lot of images that helped me frame the story. But it seems that during the filming of that episode, the son of Lorena Encinas, one of the eight women of the gang sent to Ventura Girls School, told producers that his mother had told him that her brother, Louis, had confessed to the murder. According to Ted Encinas, his uncle Louis was one of those guys who came from Downey and went uninvited to the birthday party at the bunkhouse compound and got overly rowdy and thrown out. As a way of getting even, the Downey bunch had stuck around to take their revenge on one of the party guests. Jose had opted to leave the party early and with only one companion. He had no way of knowing that by doing so, he had put a target on his back. That means Jose would have already been dying when Hank Leavis and his friends arrived at the party. Lorena's allegiance to her brother had been stronger than her allegiance to her friends. She only told her son the truth shortly before her own death in 1991. So, was there rejoicing in finally knowing the truth? Well, not exactly. It's possible it's not the truth at all. There are problems with the story when it's placed next to other testimony from that night. Specifically, Encinas indicated the attack by her brother took place between 11 and 11:30 that night. Other eyewitnesses say they saw Jose alive around 12:45 a.m., 15 minutes before the 38th Street bunch showed up. Also, the two women who found him both testified that his pockets had been turned out. Jose Diaz had been paid that day. Maybe he was in the process of resisting a robbery when he was struck and stabbed by someone else entirely. One witness, Eleanor Coronado, testified that she had seen friends Luis Vargas and Andrew Torres with Diaz a few minutes before the men left the party. Vargas and Torres were never questioned and never detained. Luis Encinas died in 1972 during a failed bank robbery, taking his own life rather than face arrest. And so, the mystery remains unsolved. Hank Lavis eventually got out again. In his later years, he ran a restaurant called Hank's on Whittier Boulevard in East Los Angeles, where members of his family worked. Young activists from the Brown Berets, a Chicano youth movement born in the 1960s, would sometimes come by to ask his advice. On July 6, 1971, Hank left a bar in East Los Angeles to call home from a phone booth. He went back inside. Soon after, he died of a heart attack. He was 48 years old. Ben Margolis, the lawyer who represented the Sleepy Lagoon defendants on appeal, would later say of him, quote, "The same person under different circumstances would have moved toward leadership. He was very bright, not much education. He had great emotions. But most important was he had the greatest sense that he was a member of a group that was being walked on, being discriminated against, and that he was going to fight against it." End quote. As of 2024, almost half, between 48 and 49%, of all those who live in Los Angeles County are of Hispanic or Latino origin. Of those, more than 70% are of Mexican origin. The Sleepy Lagoon murder and the riots that followed demonstrated how deep Anglo animosity toward the Mexican-American presence in Los Angeles ran more than 80 years ago. And there's an irony there. California, of course, was a part of New Spain until 1821, when it became part of Mexico. It was ceded to the United States in 1848, which piqued the question. A question no one asked at the time, and no one asks now. Who was there first? Or first after the Tongva, who had been there for thousands of years? And the story of those 2 years in Los Angeles captured the attention of playwright Luis Valdez, who wrote Zoot Suit, with the cooperation of Alice McGrath. It became the first Chicano play ever to be produced on Broadway. In 1981, the story was made into a movie starring Edward James Olmos. That work is just part of the artistic responses to the events. Ultimately, the riots are considered a defining moment of racial injustice and the start of what became known as the Chicano Rights Movement. The number and strength of the organizations in the community that fought for equality increased manifold after 1942. Jose Diaz is buried in Calvary Cemetery in East Los Angeles. Sleepy Lagoon, as a reservoir, no longer exists. The Armory is still there. It's a Los Angeles Fire Department training facility. It has California Historical Landmark status for its role during the war. There is no marker that remembers the riots. In 2023, the LA City Council and County Board of Supervisors officially condemned the riots. They also apologized. The city's and county's law enforcement had not done its duty, they said. They had not protected the victims of the riots. They had not served the community as a whole. To research and write this episode, journalist Amy Wilson read Murder at the Sleepy Lagoon, Zoot Suit's Race and Riot in Wartime L.A. by Eduardo Obregón-Pegón. She watched the PBS American Experience episode on the Zoot Suit riots and consulted biographical materials from the series. She also referenced court documents, newspaper archives, and articles from the National World War II Museum and other historical sources. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod. And you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.